Welcome to the Script and Style Show, the web show where we talk about web development with the people that make it happen. Today's episode is brought to you by TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring. Know when errors hit your website with the context to find and fix bugs fast with TrackJS. Start your free trial today at trackjs.com. Hey, everybody. We are live. Welcome to the Script and Style Show, the web show where we talk about web development and the people that make it happen. I'm Todd Gardner from TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring, and my co-host David Walsh, creator of the popular blog davidwalsh.name. How's it going today, David?
I'm great, Todd. How are you?
I am awesome. It is a new year, and we are trying a new kind of show.
We're back, man.
You want to tell them about what we're doing?
Yeah, so basically what we wanted to do was, surely people are tired of hearing just Todd and I talk. So
say it ain't so.
let's be real. So what we did was we brought in a bunch of talented people to help us out with sort of a panel show.
And a few not talented people.
But that's you and I. We were here before. But we want to get broader ideas from people of different experiences, and we thought this was the best way to do it. And Todd, I'll let you introduce the first round of unbelievably talented people.
Awesome. So we have four people joining us on our panel today. First, Eric Brandis, my partner in crime, co-founder and CTO of TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring. Thanks for joining, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Next up, we have Lemon. He makes you laugh on the internet about the internet with his online websites like damn.dog and idiots.win, hosts the podcast, the F Plus, and then he occasionally builds websites for agencies. Thanks for being with us, Lemon.
I mean, you know, in the remaining time, like if I need beer money.
Yeah. Pretty much. Christina Duravaj is also joining us on today's panel. She also makes websites, but she does it to fund her habit of wiring together LED electronics to make fashionable, geeky outfits and accessories. Fair?
Yeah, to someone's fashion, I guess, but that's fine.
you should have told me your own description instead of letting me make one up.
That's fine. Thanks for being on the show.
And finally, Lindsay Padgett is a consultant at GitGrit.com, a Git consulting and training to help developers be awesome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Well, so the first thing that we want to do in our new show format is talk about the news, right, David?
Yeah, lots going on.
So I read this thing today on the Register about the U.S. Department of Homeland Security issuing an emergency directive to everybody, to all of the other government agencies, that they had to lock down DNS records, change passwords, add two-factor authentication, a bunch of stuff, because there is like this massive increase in hacking attempts against government websites during the shutdown. And the article goes on to say that only 43% of tech workers right now in the government are even on the job. So like there's tons of people attacking government websites and taking them down during the shutdown because nobody can even see what's going on.
Who would have thought that this shutdown would have turned bad?
It apparently affects things.
Yeah. One of the things that sort of bugged me was that they weren't doing all of this stuff already.
Why weren't they locked down before?
I have no idea, but it seems like... it seems like a bad time to figure this out. And it seems like something that's, you know, incredibly important. Working for Mozilla, I think a lot about privacy and not just hacking. And it seems like we have a pretty big problem on our hands that we're finding out during one of the worst times to do so.
Well, there was in SSL things happened too, because there was a bunch of .gov URLs that were losing their SSL cert because it was up for renewal, and there's basically nobody to install the new certificate. And all these certificates were purchased, these certificates were purchased from GoDaddy and then like installed on government servers.
And which makes you wonder, why are they using GoDaddy for anything? Like that is not an appropriate use of my tax dollars.
Yeah.
Like that is.
Super Bowl commercials paid off for GoDaddy.
Danica Patrick wins again.
Yeah, I've been watching a bunch of these like go down like one by one, and in all of these cases where the site goes down, you realize that it's not one bad decision. It's like five bad decisions on top of each other that's making these websites just die. And I mean, hopefully it's a learning experience.
In a way, it's like this ultimate, you know, global game of a Netflix chaos monkey. Is like, what if we take the part of the system that we're going to have randomly fail is the government itself. And it's just going to like, what happens when all the people just stop showing up for work?
Except it's real.
Yeah. It's the crazy thing.
It makes sense though. SSL certs are like one thing that's very manual. And I don't know, in general, I think of IT, like sometimes I get a little irked about development getting lumped in with IT because IT seems very like manual monitoring. You really have to stay on top of these things. And so, yes, there's a human being who has to do some action. And like you said, after a month, more than a month of being on shutdown, it's like, yeah, a couple of things in sequential order leads to this.
It almost kind of buys into this this pretend world that we have where, you know, you're in the situation where you're like, oh, I don't make things. I build systems so that the things run themselves. You know, I build a Jenkins project so that this thing builds this thing, so that this thing, and then like whatever human touches the button, mm-hmm. like who cares? But then when you actually remove that human, it's like, well, not really, because the build process will probably fail and somebody's going to have to get in there and yep. tweak with it.
I also thought it was interesting. Oh, I was just going to say, I've heard that there's an uptick in like flexible job postings too. So like Upwork, flex jobs, things like that. They've said that there's a huge uptick in furloughed or, you know, government contractors who are more skilled, especially in IT web development that are now on those sites because they need to get paid. So, mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I would imagine that a lot of top talent that was in the government for whatever reason before has seriously reconsidered mm-hmm. their career options. I mean, if you are like a security person working at a high level of government, but you could go to some security firm and get paid, you know, reliably every week. I think you might.
Well, because you took the job that you thought was supposed to be reliable and sustainable. It's a government job, mm-hmm. right? I mean, what's that? That's not going to fade out. That's not going to fade out.
Yeah.
In less globally impacting news, but probably closer to the hearts of a lot of developers, Firefox released something this week too, didn't they, Lemon?
I'm super excited about it. I don't know if I personally, my primary is the FDE, the Firefox Developer Edition. Probably about half a year ago, they, in their developer tools, they did a CSS grid inspector. And once you actually click on an element in the CSS grid inspector, it's neat because you get to see like purple lines and you get to see like in this sort of like new paradigm of CSS grid, like how that thing came to be. And this week they did the same thing for Flexbox. So if you go to any site that actually is using Flexbox, I was just testing on some of my own sites, you can then open the thing up in DevTools, and then you can see like purple lines. And like, you know, in a Flexbox, you'll have a situation where it's like, this is 50%. And now in the Firefox inspector, it's like, this is 50%, and here's why. It's 50% because you said 40%, plus you said flex grow 1, plus you said max width this. And so you can actually see, like, not only dimension of the thing, but, like, why it ended up at that dimension, which is, I mean, it's a neat improvement.
Yeah, that's
sure.
awesome.
As somebody who saw it come up behind the scenes, a ton of work went into this and a ton of passion. I know our UX engineers were incredibly excited about it and were very, very focused on making sure that it was successful. So it's really cool to hear that feedback from you, Lemon, and hopefully we hear more feedback just like it.
Yeah, I think especially, I mean, like both of those things, both Grid and Flexbox, like have the sort of paradigm we have to learn it. And the syntax is different than anything else that's in CSS for both of those things. And so the idea of like, here's why the layout looks like it is, like from the browser thing, is I think really nice to have.
That's awesome. I think that's going to be super helpful for a bunch of developers going forward. David, you didn't have anything to do with that, did you?
No, apparently it's there and it's working really well. So clearly I had nothing to do.
Glad to hear it. Glad to hear it. It'll be bug free for a long time. All right. Well, then let's move on to our main topic of the day. What's that, David?
Testing. We're going to talk about the thing that we both love and we both hate. The thing that takes up way too much time and the thing that saves us a lot of time down the road.
What's the sexiest development topic we can think of? Yes, testing. That's it.
Let's bring them in.
We did, and that was the word we used for it too. We were imagining like a scandalous test framework and thinking that that's really going to get some eyeballs.
Unit testing
on this,
is the exercise of development world. Like we all know we should do it, but we probably won't.
The exercise of the development world. Well, that segues perfectly into kind of like the first question about like, why should we bother testing software? Or why do we bother not testing software? Like, if it's exercise and we know we should, but we don't, why aren't we? What makes us feel like we should test it, I guess, is a good first step.
I can kick off first. One of the big issues that came up during my time working at agencies is that clients expected everything you did to work and weren't necessarily willing to pay for the time to do the testing, right? And that's one of the massive shames. I don't want to go about and say developers are lazy because I understand the pressures that come with needing to meet deadlines, billable hours, so on and so forth. So that's one of the reasons I think that we don't test.
Well, I think
that's why we're developers.
I think developers,
so we can make computers do the things we don't want to do.
I think one thing that I've seen over and over when it comes to testing is like testing's not fun, right? It's like flossing. Like nobody wants to floss, right? But you're supposed to. And the same with developers, right? And so I've seen developers, they will spend hours and hours developing some kind of new abstraction instead of spending 10 minutes just testing their code, right? Because they hate it so much and because it's not fun, they will spend any amount of time to get away from it, you know? Even though they know that they're supposed to, it's just like the least fun part of software development, I think.
Absolutely. And I think there's also like a rush sometimes of, oh my God, it works, that you sort of want to zoom on to the next thing. And the testing gets left behind.
Because deep down, you know, it probably didn't actually work for you, right? You probably know there's like some input or a way to click that's going to break it, but you don't want to think about that case because you have to go through all that code you just like wrote and try and like trace it.
You don't want to take the victory away from yourself. Like,
exactly.
I already figured this out. I don't want to like not figure it out, unfigure it out.
Mm-hmm. Because what if I have to change it?
It's such a weird process too. Like you start out from this doesn't work and then you make it so it does work. And then you nominate yourself for the job of breaking it. Well, no, no. I spent 2 days specifically not clicking the button that I knew would break it. I've trained myself.
And you know what? You just touched on exactly why there's this contentious relationship between developers and QA, because QA's job is to find holes in the code that you write. And you're like, oh no, there can't be any, just don't bother, go home, you know? But as far as the benefits of testing, the benefits are not today. Mm-hmm. The benefits will always be in the future. So just like flossing or exercising, like you don't really see the benefits immediately. The time that you thank yourself for writing a unit test is 3, 6, 12 months from now.
Which is, of course, why it never gets done, because humans are like terrible at delaying gratification now for some sort of future benefit, right? I mean, it's like why, like, you know, 80% of the population is paycheck to paycheck or whatever, right? Like, it's like, oh, like saving for someday.
Yeah.
That's not as cool as just
I'm eating the marshmallow now rather than chew a marshmallow in 5 minutes.
Yeah. I was just going to say, especially if you're not going to be around. So if you know you're not going to be on this project or at this job 12 months from now, you probably won't bother. It's true. Yeah. Sorry, Todd, go ahead.
Yeah, you're kicking that problem out to the next poor developer who's going to pick up and, you know, run your legacy
and
code forward.
Curse your name to everyone they meet. Like that guy just screwed this up.
But
so
the dirty little secret is that you picked up the previous developer's dirty little secret and carried
it's
forward.
All one
so you've
big,
already fought the battle. So it's just one one kind of, you know, incestuous relationship around and around in circle where we're picking up and creating a problem for the next developer.
Yep.
Just like the one we just fought.
Before, like, one thing that we should also mention in our favor is the fact that not only is testing not fun, the tools can be really difficult to use if the tools are there at all, right? Anyone who's worked with, for example, Selenium testing knows that Selenium can be a total pain sometimes. And no matter what abstraction you're using, sometimes just getting the right version installed and such is a massive problem. So we do need to give ourselves a little bit of a break. However, to follow up with what Lindsay said, the amount of pain it costs us up front is not even a tenth of what it's going to save us in the future.
Yeah, there's also this thing too of like your reward for writing good tests in a comprehensive test suite is hearing nothing, like when you don't hear stuff and it's really hard to quantify. Like I have time to spend on other things now than fixing a ton of bugs, but that is generally what success looks like.
I once worked for an IT manager who had this thing of like, you know, everybody wants to make IT and software more like a utility where, you know, you turn on the lights and it just works, like the power just works. And if you have a good test suite, you can get close to that, but you don't get funded that way. And so every once in a while, you just need a catastrophic bug to remind everybody, hey, we're still here. You still need to give us enough time
and
money.
Maybe that's what the government shutdown
is. That is true.
Maybe they're trying to illustrate how important they are.
I'm not sure that anybody in the government is illustrating that we should raise taxes and that's the solution. I don't think that's the rhetoric that's going around. Okay, so we've talked about like, you know, we defer gratification for testing. All the benefits of testing are all in the future. Is that the reason why we don't do it? Why we're all just why if you choose not to spend that time testing, are you just doing it because, I'm not going to get anything out of this right now?
Part of it needs to be a cultural thing, right? Like, no matter what your organization or project, if you don't create a culture or an expectation of testing, it's probably not going to happen. So I think that a big part of why aren't we doing it? Another reason is if the culture isn't there, the people around you aren't going to do it as well. If you think that you can submit a good chunk of code and think that no one is going to be thinking on the other side, well, was this tested? How do we know this is going
to
work?
I think that's why it's super important to have the test be part of any pull request. So when new code goes in, if the expectation from the team or the architect is that the tests need to be there too, then it needs to be in the same pull request. I think that's where the slippery slope starts is like, oh, we'll do it later. I've seen like done checklists in Agile or Kanban or whatever, and it doesn't have the same effect because it just doesn't enforce that it has to go along with.
Yeah, it's really easy, especially when you're reviewing to see if the code, like if the test is like actually effective, to see the change that went into the logic and you see the change in the test or you see the test addition. It's way more easier than like this gigantic pull request of tests. And it's just like, it's great, whatever. Does it pass? Okay, fine.
I also feel like there's something to it being, I mean, for me, it feels like it's something that a paradigm that's sort of new, that this idea of, you know, like integration testing and automated testing and unit testing, like these are all fairly new terms that aren't, that weren't around, you know, a couple of years ago, and that there's not in my reading, there's not like an established like this is the way you do it. It's a bunch of people doing things that work 60% of the time, and so if there's not a way to do testing that makes sense that gets stuff done as an established like metric, I guess that's the thing that I've had problems with, is that like my testing is incredibly minimal. I mean, I'm ashamed to say it, but it is. And so it's just sort of sprinkled on top of things, specifically because I don't have a good way to do it that's been established for me, like with limited resources.
I think that's fair. I think, you know, testing, there's a lot of people who come into the testing community and say that, like, thou shalt do this, or thou shalt have, like, write your test first, or have, you know, 100% code coverage. And that's just not a realistic outcome for a lot of projects and a lot of people. And it might not be, you know, a good use of everybody's time. Have any of you had those kind of situations where you've had to fight against maybe, you know, testing that wasn't valuable?
Yeah, I worked at a company where we had to, there was a component library that was company-wide you had to contribute back to. And to get it into the component library, you had to have 100% code coverage. And we all tried being like, this is not going to work well, A. And then it's like very hard to do that with the deadlines that we have. Because we'd get a feature, and then that feature would need a component, and we'd still be on the deadline for that original feature, but with this added cycle of getting this component contributed back, and then they needed 100% code coverage, and it's like, please don't. But my solution was to get another job.
That's a very good solution. I think a lot of people assume that testing is just benevolent, right? Like every test that you write is just like one more good thing for your software. But I think, you know, if you spent any time in like a test-driven environment or like on these companies that have these huge test suites, like there is some value sometimes to these massive test suites for sure. But there is also a massive cost to maintain that. I mean, it's more code, right? So like code is sort of, you know, atrophies the longer it lives. And the more of it you have, like the more maintenance work it's going to be. So that test suite can't just live forever like without people touching it. It takes work to keep it up to date. And so I think like I've definitely seen the scenario where the tests actually become a burden, right? Like the system can't change because every time you try to make the littlest change, you know, 1,000 tests fail and you're spending up all your time just cleaning up these tests, or the tests are super brittle. Like they've got all of this, you know, internal knowledge about how the code works. So the minute you try and refactor, which is supposedly the benefits that testing gives you, right? Like the confidence to refactor. But the minute you change anything, even some internal private method, the code blows up, right? And then there's like 50 tests that you need to change. And so I do think that like there is too much of a good thing, maybe, when it comes to some testing.
I've seen that happen when functions in the JavaScript landscape, when functions get out of control. So like one of my general rules is I never want to see a function that's longer than the screen, more or less, right? And that's when it becomes very difficult to write a unit test that is concise and that doesn't have knowledge of the internal workings. So it kind of implies that the original code wasn't written optimally if the tests are that brittle. But also something I've seen is people testing the frameworks that they're using, not their own code. So I'll give a really good example. Okay, so I tend to use Angular a lot, and there's like a click event, right? People will do a lot of setup. In Angular, a lot of it's just setup. Like once you've got the setup, the test is easy to write. But they will do a lot of setup to get to like simulate a click on a button. Right. So now it's not even a unit test anymore. It's more like an end-to-end test. And then they'll assert that something happened with the click event. But you're really just testing that like click binding works. And Angular does that for you. Like that's not your code. So just mock the event for the click handler, right? And send that in and go about your business. So that's a pretty common example. And I think people hear these things, but they don't see it in their own code. And that's why I kind of like tell that anecdotal story, because it's easy to see that you're not testing your own code there.
There's a few things in the story you just told that I want to like unpack, because like you mentioned both, you know, unit testing and end-to-end testing, and I think not everybody is super clear about what those things are. So when on a consulting gig I did years and years ago, I walked in and there was like this outsourced engineering group building an e-commerce tool. And I asked about how they went about testing. And he said, well, you know, every developer will unit test the thing that they're working on. And I took it as read and moved on. But we had all these terrible, terrible bugs in the stuff that they were writing. So after a week or so, I dug in. I'm like, so tell me about explicitly, how did you test this thing? And he said that, well, a developer will pick up a task and will code that task.
A task or a unit.
And then they will open the application and check that it does what they think it does. And that is us testing the unit. Mm. And I'm like, so we obviously have very different definitions of what a unit test is. I call what you were doing as being, you know, a responsible adult. a unit test to me is something different, something automated, something that like is programmatic. So when we say unit test, what are the attributes of a unit test to you? Anyone?
I mean, that's like the ultimate tabs versus spaces in the testing world, right? Like, how do you define the scope of unit? Like, I always think like, if your test goes out of process, if your test goes over the network, like those are clear signs that it's not a unit test, right? Like, but then like I take a very like sort of heretical view of unit testing, and my thought is if you mock something, you're doing it wrong. Like the minute that you have some sort of mock or you're verifying some function got called internally, like that's a bad test too. And you've failed. Like a unit test.
That's a bad test or it's not a unit test?
It's both, I guess. It's a bad non-unit test. But like to me, a unit test is there is a function that takes inputs. And if I give it those inputs, it will give me deterministic outputs, right? And that is the extent of it. I don't mock anything. I can stub things. I can have sort of empty data bags that I pass around, like just set a few properties. But inputs, deterministic outputs, right? Like to me, that is a unit test sort of at its most basic definition.
Well, and I want to get into terminology, and I'm sure we'll get into this later when we're talking about specific tools, but mocks versus spies versus stubs. And I used the word mock earlier, but I think really what I meant was stub data. Like you're feeding something in so that you can figure out what's coming out.
Yep.
Right. And that's the best kind. Yep. I mean, that's incidentally why pure functions are great things in JavaScript. You can send them in. You know that when X goes in, Y comes out. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And you don't have to worry about how to make X. It doesn't really matter. But then
imagine I got this X from somewhere, right? Like it's over the network, maybe it's whatever, but I have this X.
Right. So just to be clear, I mean, doing that, like setting up that data, in my mind, in a mock way, doesn't mean it's not a unit test. Like that's actually makes it a unit test, is that it's like pretend data that you're feeding.
So when I say mock, I generally mean mock in terms of like, you've got this fake object that either like recorded some behavior that you want it to do. A classic example is like you've got a service that returns stuff from a database. Well, you don't want it to go to the database in the unit test. You want it to just give you some data back, right? And so you'll mock that function so that it returns, data of your choosing. Whereas a stub is just like a plain old object or something, right, that you pass it. It's just the raw data versus like this additional behavior layer.
Yep. Like a service. I mean, service would be something you'd have to mock.
Exactly.
You're calling into that other thing.
I don't like it when services are inside the code that's under unit tests, right? Like I'm like, pull your service out of there, call the service somewhere else, get the thing, and then pass it through that function that does the logic.
Gotcha. Yep. Totally agree.
Yep.
So then the other kind of testing that we've talked about a little bit is end-to-end testing. And so what is that and how is it different?
I can go here. For me, it would just be, it doesn't matter what, not necessarily, you can see if you want to test for what functions are called, but the actual contents of those functions is just when I have a web page and I put in something in this field, what happens? Or if I try putting error value, like a unit test would be if you have like a JavaScript validation function, you call that function with some text and does it return true or false? And an end test would be you actually put data into the field and do whatever and hit the button and then see how that appears on the screen.
Like, does an error message show in the UI or does the form submit successfully or that sort of thing?
Yep.
So in general, you're talking about like we're orchestrating a browser, right? We're clicking on things and interacting as though a user would. Those are hard.
Yeah.
Has anybody done a lot of browser testing, like end-to-end testing for web pages?
Yep.
And what's your experience with that?
Sadness, regret. But no, I had when I was a contractor, I did a job where we had a lot of Selenium tests that we would write for it. And I think we used a Groovy tool called Jeb, if I'm remembering this right. I could be wrong. But that was just Selenium with some Groovy layer on top of it. And then at my current job, I came in and it was Nightwatch with Selenium. And then we converted it to another tool, which I guess we can talk about now or later. But yeah, it was just like you get it. There's a lot of stuff being fragile because, you know, a website can be slow for a number of reasons. And especially Selenium, if it doesn't see the thing it wants, it will just be like, OK, you failed. And it's just like, no. So there's a lot of dot waits, a lot of retries. And all of that is just you running something a bajillion times and figuring out, like, is it actually a problem in the code that we need to fix? And sometimes it is, and that's great to find those things, but most of the time it's just something being flaky.
Yeah, Christina hit that dead on. I mean, I have a lot of experience with Selenium testing, and when you're trying to do this testing, you're fighting a whole bunch of stuff, right? You're fighting the browser, you're fighting Selenium, you're fighting the environment, and you're also doing a hell of a lot of polling because of all the async structure that we're using these days. And so when we talked earlier about why aren't we testing, it's really hard, especially this type of testing. I really like unit tests and such, but if you're expecting users to go to your site, click on this, then see this, then do this, the only way to make sure it's happening is to do this type of testing. Because with unit testing or even integration testing, something's going to fall through. So you need to write really detailed tests, and you're relying on all these things that sort of feel like duct tape. I mean, like, I don't want to speak badly of Selenium, but we all know that it can be spotty or difficult mm-hmm. sometimes. And especially with my experience writing tests for dev tools, you know, sometimes you get a different result based on whether you're doing headless testing or actually doing the opening of the browser testing too. So it's just, it's so difficult. It's so hard. And that's something we need to admit.
I totally agree that tooling is not good. Although, you know, shout out to the people who work on Puppeteer from Chrome. Yeah. That is definitely, in my mind, that's like kind of the next revision of Selenium, right? Like, yes, it's only Chrome. So if you care about cross browser oddities, yeah, you're not going to, you know, it's not going to help you with those. But if you're just trying to like smoke test your app and like, okay, I just did a deploy, run it through like the 80% of stuff that users do. I think Puppeteer is actually a great tool that solved a lot of that waiting and stuff. Like you still have to put waits in sometimes, but they've got a better API. You don't just put milliseconds and you say, wait for this element to appear. Right. And that kind of thing.
Nice.
So I think that's pretty cool. And it's also async by default. Everything returns promises. So you can use async await in your code. And the last thing I want to say about the end-to-end testing is, even though it's got all those problems, like David said, like it's the only true way to know if your system works. Like if you got unit tests and all the tests pass and everything's green, your app could still be horribly broken. And I see it all the time. But if those Selenium tests actually pass, like if you're able to upload the file or you were able to actually like enter your name or whatever, like it really worked, you know? So that's like the one difference. Like there's a lot of false failures with Selenium, but there's a lot of false like successes with unit tests where you think things are good when they aren't. And so I do think there's quite a lot of advantage to those end-to-end tests and sort of fighting through that.
Yeah, there's definitely advantages to both.
Because,
no, I was just going to say there's definitely advantages for both.
Sorry, Christina, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. And places that I've worked where, the end-to-end testing is used, I think, is most effective when it's like the core flow of your application, the thing that can't fail. You know, if the whole point is somebody getting in and going to a message board or something, like just testing that flow and making sure.
Christina, like you had mentioned that you've been using another tool recently. What is that?
We switched all our Nightwatch tests to using Cypress, which is a JavaScript tool. It doesn't use Selenium. I actually don't know the technical details of how it works, but it's a little different it's very opinionated in a way that I was not used to with Selenium. Like in Selenium, I mean, maybe we wrote tests poorly and that's completely fair, but like we actually would go to the login website and log in, and then it would take you to the page that you were actually building and then do all the stuff. In Cypress, when I was started like converting all the tests over, I was like, okay, how do I do this? And Cypress explicitly makes that like very, very hard or to impossible, because one of the guys who writes it gave a talk at assert.js, where it's like, that isn't what you're testing. Like you're not testing the login screen, or if you are, that's like a separate functional test. Like if you're here to test your web page, then log in programmatically, log in with an API call and access your page that way. And like now that I went from like, let me try this tool to this is not working easily to like getting mad about it. And then I like watched this talk and like, that makes sense. And why weren't all of my tests written this way to begin with? So it's a little bit more opinionated than I thought Selenium was, or Selenium is, but it does the thing where it waits for elements for a certain period of time. It's less flaky in general. And I really like it. You can record videos. So when we have our end-to-end tests run and they fail, videos are saved so you can see where they fail. There's a really, really nice interface for doing, it'll go through all your tests and stepwise, and you can go back in time and see what the page looked like when this like step was hit. It's really, really, really nice. So I really liked Cypress a lot for the JavaScript type of stuff. There's some limitations. They list those out. But for what we were doing of just testing a JavaScript app, it worked really well.
Awesome. So you don't know if Cypress different than Puppeteer or built on top of Puppeteer?
It's not built on Selenium. I've never heard of Puppeteer, actually. So that's my bad, I guess. But
well, that's all right. I mean, there's so much happening in the JavaScript space, you can't possibly know about everything. It's ridiculous. So we talked about unit testing. We talked about end-to-end testing. A lot of like new developers or people who are just starting to get into the testing, they are super confused about like what kind of testing they should do. There's a lot of like stuff that gets thrown around. For a long time, there was the testing pyramid. I've been seeing a lot of tweets lately in the web space about the testing trophy.
What is that?
Which looks like the same thing with different ratios.
What's a trophy? Like do you get a trophy if you do it right, or what? Like
no, it's saying that you should have a lot of unit tests and a lot of end to end tests and fewer integration tests. So it's the same idea as the testing pyramid, which, you know, used to say you should have a lot of unit tests, a few integration tests, and a handful of end-to-end mm-hmm. tests. It's the same idea where it's prescribing how many you should have. It's just in a
so
different
it reminds me of the nutrition pyramid a little bit then, kind of, right? Like at first we were supposed to have like, I don't know, grains or whatever the hell it was on the bottom. And now it's like it should be all protein and no carbs. Like carbs are the devil now, right? And so it's like, oh.
Maybe it's just called the testing trophy to get people to do it because they think they're going to get something out of
us. Developers
get a little Xbox.
We didn't get a lot of trophies when we were kids, so you know.
Yeah,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah,
so I'm hearing a lot of just general mocking of this idea. Nobody's found any value in
sure
either. Of
these
concepts.
I'm sure it's a trophy? Solid concept. I feel patronized that they think we have to have a shape to remember what to do.
I think it's a Kent Dodds blog post.
Okay. I feel like there's something to like trying to get into that rewards loop, you know, like the idea of the unit testing going from red to green. I mean, is like inherently satisfying to make a red thing green. I mean, like I've spent a bunch of time doing things on my phone, making numbers get bigger just because I have that part of my brain that like says that's a good thing. So like red to green testing is good. And so if you can encourage these kind of behaviors with something that like eats into that part of the psyche, great. On its face, like test trophy does not resonate with me, but you know.
But that's why test driven development is awesome. I mean, I
well, sure.
I believe that it satisfies that need, right? It starts off red. especially for bugs, right? If you're mm-hmm. bug fixing and you know that this bug should never happen again, which it shouldn't because you're fixing it, right? Like, write the test first, it's red, and when you fix it, it turns green. And then you're done with testing. You don't have to go back and do it later.
So I totally agree on the like bug fixing test. Like that is absolutely a great place for test-driven development. But like, I don't know if I agree with test-driven development for like greenfield or new stuff, especially if it's like front end or UI based stuff. Like I feel like you've got to,
I agree.
You got to have that ability to play a little bit. You know what I mean? Like try a bunch of different APIs out and ergonomically like look at the different stuff and see how it looks. Because the minute you start writing those tests, you've basically entombed your code yes. in this big test wrapper. And so now like changing it or moving directions is like, you've got this huge drag associated with that's trying true. To make big sweeping changes. So that's why like, I think it's perfect. I love what you say about the bug fixing. Because like, I know this code was good enough to go to production and there's a bug in it, but I don't need to like, I'm not playing anymore. Like this is the way I settled on. But yeah, it's so hard to like start yes. with
TDD.
Is
great if it's right? concise.
And just like, okay, I've got.
Yeah. If the code you're mm-hmm. writing is concise or like it's very well known what you're doing. APIs are another one. So I used to do back-end APIs all day long. It's input in, output out. Like, you know, that's a TDD scenario too. But yes, I agree. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right, so we're kind of closing in on the time we have today, but I wanted to just kind of open it up and talk about testing stories, like get some ideas from you about like, can you tell us about a time, any of our panelists, about a time when having tests in place on your system really saved your butt, like that you thanked either yourself from 6 months ago or the previous developer for having that thing in place.
I have a good one recently, actually. One of the things that I'm implementing within the Firefox DevTools debugger is column breakpoints, right? So we're all used to adding a breakpoint at a line, but now I'm also going to let you add it at a column in that line so you can stop exactly where you want. And so everything was going great. And what we do for DevTools, I'm sorry, for the debugger is like its own beast, right? Because it's built with React. And we have this thing called a launch pad so that you can work on it in the browser. So you don't have to build Firefox every time you make a change to see if something's working. Everything worked great in this launch pad. Everything worked great when I ran my Selenium testing. However, one of the tests had a test for when one of the Firefox preferences was turned off. And of course, you guys can change any pref you want at any time. It turns out that something within my column breakpoint code wasn't accommodating for that preference, in which case, if you had that preference, the debugger within Firefox would just brick. Mm. You'd see a white screen. I was very happy we had those tests. And it just sort of speaks with like the more configuration you give your users, the more complex something can be, obviously the more testing you're going to want, but the more liabilities you have. So in this case, testing saved my butt completely. And actually might have saved your butt too, since it's in your Firefox. So. I mean, how about you, Todd? I mean, you're shipping code to, you know, like if something goes wrong with TrackJS, you're not breaking TrackJS.com only. You're shipping code all over the place. Like what is sort of your experience and your safety net with
I mean, such a tool? I echo a lot of what I've heard today. So the code that we ship out to everybody is this little agent code that sits in everybody else's web page. And we have like extensive unit tests on it, but also a bunch of end-to-end tests that use Selenium, because we actually have to target, you know, most of the issues that crop up actually come from a browser implementation. Like it's some weird thing that Safari does, or, you know, Chrome has introduced this new behavior or whatever. But most of the failures that we get in Selenium are fighting mm-hmm. Selenium. Like I'm glad that they're there and I don't want to delete them, but my first thought when a test fails isn't that my code broke. It's that I'm going to run the test again. And if the same test breaks twice, I'll be like, okay, Maybe I'll look into this.
It's still a Selenium problem, right? It's just that it's configured wrong.
It still is. It's probably I need to increase the timeout from 5 seconds
or
to
Sauce 10. Or SauceLabs changed which version of the browser they're like testing with. And so
we forgot to talk about ego-driven development. That's like
I actually think that's fair.
See, I feel like it's pain-driven development. It's like I have gone into the depths of like the Selenium log so many times just to find out that like, oh, a WebDriver changed support for this behavior and now I have to do it in this other way. I've had to do that so many times that, you know, my first suspicion is that it's either Sauce Labs, which we use for, you know, all the remote browsers, or it's Selenium itself that is the problem. But I'm still happy that it is there because very occasionally, a test breaks because, oh crap, that new version of Firefox dropping is, you know, changing this behavior in some way. And, oh, we should probably accommodate that in this check for how an error gets thrown. And so I'm very, very happy that they're there and that we took the time to build them.
I think that...
But they're not...
That falls under integration, right? Anytime you're dependent on something in an outside system, whether you're embedded in a browser or whatever, like I've worked a lot with APIs and despite semantic versioning, like people change stuff, they don't tell you. And so there's that. Under that
definition though, like the whole web has to be an integration test because we are all at the mercy of the browser vendors.
That's true. No, I my kind of most valuable testing story was actually more of like a slow burn, where we I worked at a company that did a lot of scraping for partners that didn't have APIs. They were like, no, we'll figure it out. They wrote scrapers and they had a suite of those. And of course, anytime a button changed its ID or something, if, you know, it would break. And so we had very little testing around that. And I call it a slow burn because it was sucking away so much of our time to chase those things down. So the tester I wrote, would it basically capture the DOM? Like that's what a scraper does, is it, you know, gets a hold of the markup. And it would record that. And then every day it would run the test at the same time and see if anything had changed. And I used some sweet regex skills on that project too, to figure out, or like XPath or whatever it was, to figure out how to navigate whatever they had changed and try to react to it to the best of our abilities.
So what about stories about really frustrating tests? So I think Eric shared one earlier in the day or earlier in the show, but like stories about like where you were just so pissed off at the test setup in your project that I think, Christina, you quit.
Well, no, it was just the requirement that we couldn't move forward. The writing the test isn't, I mean, I wouldn't quit because of that, but no, I feel like every time I've had to like get into a new like testing framework or something like that, you have to relearn how everything kind of works and how to set everything up for the first time. And I always found that intensely frustrating, like just to kind of get started on either like a new thing that didn't have tests before, or like, what do I need to bring in and mock and how do I do that and all that stuff? Like what makes the most sense for testing this chunk of code for unit testing has always been like relearning from scratch for me. It's like my brain just jettisoned all the knowledge I had about testing from the last time I did it. So yeah, all of it is like what I guess what I'm saying is the frustrating part.
I think like one of the frustrations that I had last year was I was removing the old debugger from Firefox. Firefox had both the old and the new. And it turns out that a lot of the other dev tools had tests that depended on the old debugger having certain things or its presence. And so I think that one big source of frustration with definitely integration tests are things depending on each other that really shouldn't. I think that can be a big problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good time to probably wrap this up. So one of the things that I think is really cool that we should do is do a summary. We did it with the old show, and I think that should stick around. So like a takeaway of what was something, some conversation or some point that somebody made today that I think was really meaningful for the listeners to take away. David, why don't you go first? What did you come up with?
I think it's pretty incredible that we all have our own different, very unique experiences with testing. I think that it was said in jest, but the whole internet is a one big integration test, it seems like. We have browsers, we have tools, we have the code that we've written, we have the code that we didn't write. And when we were all heading, or when we were sharing our different experiences, it made me realize how much value each of us has in those experiences and how we can all help each other out moving forward. How about you, Todd?
What I really appreciate about our show today, versus a lot of, you know, blog posts or video or talks or whatever I've observed on testing, is how pragmatic everybody was here. Like, nobody came in and took the role of like, all code must be test-driven development with 100% code coverage, and that's the way it should be. Nobody came in like spewing that kind of garbage. Everybody was very pragmatic about like, well, you know, here's where it's valuable, but it kind of sucks sometimes. And so none of us really do it all the time. And like, I found that very refreshing and practical. And I think that is a good lesson to take away. How about you, Eric?
Oh,
What's your takeaway? Everybody gets a take.
I mean, I guess.
What's one thought that you would
thought is, I guess I am not actually a big fan of unit tests, but I am always, you know, hopefully willing to be wrong. And actually, this was a good reminder for me that there is actually value, and that people were telling stories where like these tests did save the day. Because, you know, when you're asking about who's got a story where tests like really saved your butt, I was like, I got nothing. Like, I just have frustrating stories. You know what I mean? but like, it was good to hear that, like, no, like, maybe I'm just being grumpy, and that, like, there, you know, like everything, it's a balance, right? You do need some unit tests. You do need some integration tests. You need some of those things, you know, and the real trick is just knowing when and where to apply that stuff. So.
Christina?
I guess for me is just, you see, I mean, I heard about Puppeteer for the first time. Cypress is a relatively new tool. I think the thing that makes me optimistic is that people are seeing where they're, you know, we all kind of admit Selenium is great, but like building some stuff can be a real big pain. And so seeing tools come out to kind of help that is makes me optimistic for the future, that maybe future Christina won't have as many headaches.
Christina, do you have anything that you want to plug as we close out the show?
Not really.
All right, Lemon, what's your takeaway?
I like having conversations with other developers of a certain mind, because I think that there's something that happens when developers talk to each other over the actual internet, which is like a whole bunch of like bullying and code shaming that is like absolutely emblematic, like, to the culture as a whole. Like, if you look at blog posts and Twitter and stuff like that, like, there's a bunch of people that do their thing, and then their thing is correct, and like, there's a feedback loop that says that you are rewarded for saying like, the thing that I do is right, and I'm going to tell you about the thing that I do, which is objectively right. And when you're coming into something that's like about failure and about testing, like, that gets so much more high stakes, because now you're actually talking about the difference between like, your code is great and your code is garbage. And so I think that like, that I really like being able to talk to people with experiences that are vastly different than mine. And everyone just agrees that like, if you can come at the thing, like, with a general concept of good faith, then you're going to do okay, but also try to do better.
That's awesome. I love that. Anything you want to plug?
I don't know. I'm close to 300 episodes of the F Plus, which is weird. I'm going to, depending on what conferences accept me this year, there's going to be hopefully one new site, which is, I'm really excited. I'm really excited. I think it might be called the Sackabot, named after Chris Sacka.
Oh Oh, I can't wait.
Is it gonna have like a West? I want to know more about this. Is there like a Western style shirt involved, or like beard?
Maybe there might be.
It'll be good. I bet.
He's such a delightful Google image search, because it's not like he has one cowboy shirt. He has hundreds of different cowboy shirts.
Yes. Everybody has something they would do if they had $1 million, you know? That's
just closets and closets of cowboy shirts.
Yes. my big takeaway, don't work for the government. Got that. testing is hard. I think we're all on board with that. But yeah, as far as anything I want to plug, so you can find more about me at lizziepaget.com. And if you want to hire me, my company's longplaysoftware.com, or GitGrit if you need Git specific love.
Awesome. And I forgot to give Eric a chance to plug something.
Oh, I don't. I'm good. Nothing to plug. Use TrackJS, everybody.
You don't want to plug maybe one of your
beats? I'm waiting to hear. I got two beats out for rappers to rap on right now. So I'm waiting to hear like the final product before, cuz it could be terrible or it could be amazing. But I don't want to plug it until I know if it's amazing. Because if it's not good,
you're not following SoundCloud rules. If you have a SoundCloud, you have to like.
I would rather as few people know about my SoundCloud as possible.
Where's your facial tattoos, dog? Come on, you want a SoundCloud this thing up? You better come correct.
So, well, it'll be a big unveil.
All right. Thanks so much, everybody, for being on the show. Thank you for watching. I hope you enjoyed this new format. If you have feedback for us on what you liked, what you don't like, please hit us up. Let us know topics. If you want to be on the show, if you want us to talk about something, if you'd like us to cover something, please let us know. We're out on Twitter. I'm at Todd H. Gardner.
At David Walsh Blog. See you next time.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. See you next time.
Bye.
The Script and Style Show is recorded and produced by David Walsh and Todd Gardner. We'll see you next time on Script and Style.